tonight, we'll follow up with really a lesson that kind of helped us set a tone last night in dealing with the idea of evolution. And of course, evolution is taught and is very popular today in the school systems, and in fact is mandated to be taught in the school system. So that particular worldview is one that is ultimately forced upon us, but those who believe in the Bible obviously deal with a conflict, and that the Bible teaches something that is very different from the theory of evolution, and that ultimately life came to be from non-life and ultimately has evolved into various species, and ultimately we are at the very end of this particular chain, on the mammalia chain or mammal chain, and that we are at the top of the chain for now, that Homo sapien or human beings. Well, that's certainly an idea, but it is not the idea that is conveyed in the Bible. In the book of Genesis in chapter 1, we read of the 6 days of creation where God creates all things, including the universe that is around us. It is in day 6, of which the Bible starts to focus in verse 26 of Genesis chapter 1. And what's interesting there is that it states that all mammalia or mammals are ultimately created in the same day. Notice there in verse 26. And God said, backing up to verse 24 is where I want to begin. God said, "Let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth, and after its kind, and it was so. And God made the beast of the earth after its kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind, and God saw that it was good." So the beast tonight is something we're going to talk about, something I would consider following in that particular category, the idea of dinosaurs. And we're going to talk about that because obviously what evolution teaches, and dinosaur being an icon of the evolutionary theory, is that supposedly these magnanimous beasts ultimately died away into some sort of extinction event some 65 million years ago, according to what is taught in the school system today. What's interesting, though, is that in verse 26, on that very same day, then God creates man. In fact, creates man in God's own image. And so the problem there is that the Bible teaches is that dinosaurs that supposedly went into extinction some 65 million years ago, preceding humans by 64,900,000 years, according to the teachings, that they could never have been created on the same day and literally never coexisted. And so tonight we're for a little bit going to talk about these ideas of whether or not dinosaurs really did become extinct 65 million years ago, and could have humans ever coexisted with them? Well, so we're going to answer a couple of questions that obviously come to mind that people even ask today. And I'm going to simplify this just a little bit more. Some people even wonder if dinosaurs are even real, even though we do find their fossils. Did they ever really exist? That's certainly a question that comes to mind. And people who believe the Bible even wonder if it's even true that they ever existed at all. And then we're going to ask the question, and then answer this particular one: how did dinosaurs become extinct? Or at least we're going to share the theory on that, because there are theories out there, but there's also a biblical answer to that as well. And what were dinosaurs like? That's a common question that comes to mind. Other questions include: who discovered dinosaurs? How? That's important for us tonight. We're going to actually take a step back into history and understand, how did we as human beings come to understand what dinosaurs are, and how did we come to believe in them, teach about them, and have the theories about them that are taught in the school systems today? How old are dinosaur fossils? And of course, we're going to have to be very brief on that. We'll at least share with you what the worldview of that is in modern science. Did dinosaurs and humans ever coexist? That's a key question, because the Bible teaches that they did. But the worldview is that supposedly they never could have potentially ever existed based on their timetable. And are discoveries still being made today? That's an obvious one. Yes, they are, and they are constantly being shared with us in the news system. We hear about them all the time. What do we really know about dinosaurs is another question that's asked. So let's start with the early discovery of dinosaurs so that we can appreciate, how did we come to understand dinosaurs? And when did this really begin to become publicized to the public in such a way as to us appreciate what we now know and really take for granted today? Kids today know a lot more about dinosaurs than anyone ever did, even more than 100 years ago, and I'll show you why. So First of all, the first and earliest known publication to actually talk about any sort of dinosaur feature or any remnant of a dinosaur is believed to be that the Chinese found particular teeth from dinosaurs some 3,000 years ago, and that they found these and they assumed them to be dragon teeth. And of course, you know, the dragon is a very key element in their particular belief system. But they would actually grind these things up and they would actually serve them out medicinally as some kind of powder that could be mixed and ultimately used in a medicinal purpose to cure people of various ailments. Well, that's at least the best idea that we have in history. But we do know that in 1676, a giant thigh bone, and the reason I put giant in parentheses there is because this giant thigh bone was found in England and ultimately published by a Reverend Robert Plot. And Reverend Robert Plot proposed that the giant thigh bone, which was some 3 feet tall, was a remnant of the giants, human beings, in the Old Testament. You read about that there were certain giants in the Old Testament. He thought that giant thigh bone belonged to the giants or the human beings in the Old Testament. But what we've later discovered, because it is still available for study and discovery, it's ultimately actually a dinosaur thigh bone is what has been determined. But that's the earliest reporting in the modern era in any kind of publication. Well, in 1770, so about the time of the independence of the United States, in the midst of our push for freedom from the English, French anatomist Georges Cuvier described a large skull found in a local quarry as a monstrous marine lizard. And so that's kind of interesting because it gives us, it's starting to give us the idea of a timeline. Here's 1676. The idea is that the first discovery that we know of this published is misidentified as being human, and that's obviously incorrect. And now we find that Georges Cuvier, a French anatomist in 1770, and giving us again a timeline, a little over 200, almost 250 years ago, describes a large marine lizard-like skull that's found in a quarry. Well, by 1796, Cuvier argued that these fossils were the remains of an extinct species. And so he's starting to catch on to something here. He's realizing these animals, being an anatomist, knows what various animals look like. This animal, this large animal, isn't really a marine lizard after all, but it has to be something unique. And so he's on to something. He's actually on the right path, but he hasn't dialed it completely in. So at around 1800, we're getting at least a little bit closer. So it's in 1818 that large bones and teeth were discovered near Oxford, England. And so these particular bones are brought to an individual by the name of William Buckland, who is a clergyman and a university professor at Oxford. And so he ultimately gets the opportunity to look at, examine these bones, and to describe them, and later then even publishes them. Well, it isn't until 1824, after consulting with Cuvier, who then becomes the father of paleontology, the study of ancient life, Buckland published the discovery of the extinct species, and he called it Megalosaurus, which means big reptile. That's the name that he ultimately described it as. But you can see here, they're still kind of hung up on the idea of whether or not it's truly reptile or just an extinct portion of reptiles, but we haven't yet got to the full disclosure that it's a dinosaur. So, there's other science going on right around this time, and this science is very popular, it's being published, and it's out in the forefront of the scientific community, and it's going to have a very large impact on the thinking of the human mind and also the scientific community that ultimately is going to impose certain theories or ideas associated with these discoveries. So it's in 1795, Scottish naturalist James Hutton writes Theory of the Earth, and he's kind of one of the forefathers of geology. He states that the earth is ancient based on slow natural processes that he would observe out in nature. For instance, if you go to Niagara Falls and you sit there and you watch all the water washing over Niagara Falls and you realize Niagara Falls really isn't eroding very rapidly and you can come back year after year and it's really hardly noticeable. And you can see the same for mountains and hills and all kinds of things. They don't really erode. It doesn't really change rapidly. So Hutton starts to believe that the earth must be really ancient. In 1830, another geologist who actually gets claimed the father of geology because he pushes out a lot of really great texts, Charles Lyell writes what's called Principles of Geology, and he argues that the present is the key to the past. And what that quote really means is what we see today must be the way it always has been, meaning if processes are slow, then things have always been slow, and therefore, if you back calculate time as to how long it takes a mountain to erode down and ultimately fill a basin, such as here in Oklahoma, which we ultimately pull oil and gas from, then everything must be really, really, really ancient. Really ancient, like beyond the scope and imagination of human thought, because it has to be so old. And so that starts to get out there in science, and people start to postulate these ideas, and the idea of an ancient Earth starts to evolve in human thought processes. Well, while this is going on, by 1840, numerous types of large lizard-like creatures have been unearthed and are being described in publications abroad. And the scientific community is excited about it because it is new discovery, and scientists live for new discovery. They want to ultimately find new things, and of course, as a scientist, you want to be the first to publish it, and you want to share that knowledge so that you can get that claim to fame. Unfortunately, the problem here is that the species recovered were only pieces of a larger picture. Let me illustrate that. In this particular case, here in the middle, you can see a large thigh bone being excavated from a quarry. Here you find what is the vertebrates of a long tail, and over here you can see obviously multiple various pieces, a scapula, a piece of a femur, part of a tail here with the vertebrates, but you can see they're only pieces mixed together in the rock, and they have to be extracted from the rock, and then you have to use imagination to wonder what do these creatures possibly look like, because we're only finding a couple of pieces of each of these animals and only wondering based on the size how large they must have been, let alone how they must have looked. So in 1841, 20 years before the Civil War here in the United States, a British anatomist by the name of Sir Richard Owen suggested a new classification of this order of species. He has discounted that they're marine lizards at all, and he wants to propose this new idea, of which he ultimately refers to as dinosaur. So Owen suggests this new taxonomy. And he calls it dinosaur, which means fearfully great reptile, so it still carries the idea to some degree, obviously, or also known as terrible lizards. So still, the reptile lizard idea is still associated, but he says, yeah, they may look like it, but they are a completely different and new classification. And so Sir Richard Owen gets the credit of coming up with this term, this new word that we use so regularly today, the word dinosaur. So not long after, dinosaurs become all the rave among the scientific community as well as the general public alike as they begin to learn about it. So the first appearance of dinosaurs in the idea of sharing them with the public is in 1854, when more than 24 life-size concrete sculptures were ultimately contracted to a very good artist who then unveiled these at the Crystal Palace Park in London, what would be an equivalent of the World's Fair at that time, even though it was only agriculture and machinery being on display at that time. What do they look like? Well, they look like this. Down here at the bottom left, here is Megalosaur, the first proposed dinosaur discovery, and its artistic rendition here as found in the Crystal Park Palace. Here is an iguanodon. Notice iguana is part of the name, and it looks a lot like an iguana. It's actually the discovery that almost was the first dinosaur discovery. It actually came just a few months too late to beat out Megalosaurus. And then, of course, here we have an ichthyosaur and a pleistosaur, and these actually look a lot like some discoveries that have been found today. But here's the deal. Here's Megalosaur, here's iguanodon, and you ask yourself, what did they find that ultimately led them to believe these are what these creatures look like in ancient times? Well, let me show you what they actually used because they were published. In 1824, the Megalosaur was published based on this jawbone and this unique tooth, and that entire artistry comes from that piece of the puzzle. Only that piece of the puzzle. Why do you not see this thing walking around in the movie Jurassic Park? Because obviously there was a lot of imagination used, and it's not very accurate. How about Iguanodon? In 1825, just a few months later after the first of that year, in 1825, these pieces were found, broken fragments of various leg bones and a little bit of a vertebrae, and it was ultimately used to come up with this entire depiction of the iguanodon. There was a little bit later on, in 1840, another pile of bones found in the same quarry that again lent to an understanding of this animal, but you can see they're not intact. And they certainly don't paint any kind of picture similar to these artistic renditions. So we saw last night, when it comes to evolution, and when it came to the human species, there was a lot of artistry put into the interpretation of what those skulls looked like to ultimately come up with the idea of all these various unique creatures that supposedly evolved all the way from a common ancestor between chimpanzee to ultimately human being. But we saw there was lots of problems with that last night, didn't we? And so again, we see the same problem coming forth in the idea of how scientists have created these ideas of what dinosaurs are from these very few fragments. Now, it's not always been the case, but we'll talk about that here in just a moment. So now let's talk about the idea of origins and evolution, because the evolutionary theory is coming around about this time, isn't it, based on the history that we know. Prior to the time of the dinosaur discovery, many naturalists believed fossils to be the result of what's called the Noachian Diluvium in science, Noah's Flood. They get away from the words that are found in the Bible, but instead just want to talk about it in a sense that's maybe not so relevant and not picked up on so quickly. So, we find, though, that a new theory is being developed and is published in 1859 by Mr. Charles Darwin in a book entitled Origin of the Species. Now, what's interesting about this is that Charles Darwin is in a unique setting in which he ultimately writes these things. He visits the Galapagos Islands. He's aboard the Beagle. He's got along with him a couple of books, not very many. One of them is James Hutton's work on the ancient Earth. And James Hutton proposing that if we find ancient life, if we find ancient fossils, it's going to lead to a validation of an ancient Earth. And so Charles Darwin has this in mind, and when he finds unique species on the Galapagos, he starts to propose the idea that he has now seen evolution in life form. And so that is going to have an impact on the science as well. So the theory of evolution would have a tremendous influence on the discovery of dinosaurs and how scientists will think about dinosaurs and fit them into the entire cluster of life and how they all relate one to another. So then becomes this interesting period. We've heard about the gold rushes in the United States, and there's other gold rushes that have occurred around the world. But you know, there was also what's called the dinosaur rush, the great dinosaur rush. And the great dinosaur rush was due to the popularity of all of these bones being discovered, because really, they were worth their weight in gold. They really were something of which many museums strived to have a specimen of and ultimately wanted in their museums. So people went out looking for these specimens, trying to find them, not because they were scientists, but because it was lucrative business. And the lucrative business ultimately elevated when museums said, you know, what we need is we need nearly complete specimens. We don't need just bones and fragments. We need something that represents the whole of the dinosaur so that we can put these things on display. We don't just need sculptures. And so, as new fossil sites were reported, bone hunters flocked to excavation sites just like they did with the Great Gold Rush. And in turn, the museums offered these fossil seekers large sums of money for these relics. And so the science of paleontology, like many sciences, was born. It was born because it was an opportunity to make some money. So then came a time what's called the Bone Wars. And this is during the Gilded Age of U.S. history, a.k.a. the Wild Wild West. So there's a time period here in our history of which individuals are flocking out trying to find things, and it's extremely competitive, and it was marketed by a heated rivalry between two prospectors in 1877 through 1892, and they were known as Athaniel Marsh and Edward Cope. One went on to become the geology professor and head up a geology department of a major university in the northeast of the United States, and the other one would ultimately go and be the first leading individual in the United States Geologic Survey. So obviously lucrative business ultimately meant big careers. Well, the business was so good that not only did you have to have the money men, including Othniel Marsh here in the middle, but you had to have the hired hands that toted the guns to protect the investments. So whether they were moving gold by stagecoach, whether they're moving dinosaur bones, these are very expensive things in that particular time frame. So then comes the Great Enlightenment in science. And in the Great Enlightenment in science that relates to this particular story, Cope and Marsh ultimately and collectively actually discover some 142 dinosaur species in the western United States alone. They had some of the largest impacts on discoveries because of how well and efficiently they went out and found particular specimens. Meanwhile, simultaneous discoveries are being made elsewhere around the world, and some of the greatest discoveries included what we call nearly complete in situ specimens, meaning in-place specimens, meaning that when you find them in place and packed it in the bone just as they laid down, you get a real idea of what the animal looked like as well as a scale of size. So what did they look like? They looked like things like this. And they looked ultimately so well preserved as to get an idea of the shape of the animal. And then what you could do is then add maybe, for instance, skin over the top of the animal. You can add some color, some skin tone, things like that. You can at least get an idea of what these animals start to look like. So we are in the mid to late 1800s. In U.S. history, world history, when people start to really appreciate what dinosaurs may have looked like as well as their scale. That's important to remember. So impose that in your mind, really kind of put that in your memory, and remember that later. 1860s, 1870s, man starts to really get an impression of what a dinosaur might have looked like in the past. So now let's talk about for a moment here the geologic timescale, because it's important to note this as well. Because this is a huge contrast to knowing what when we finally started to appreciate these animals versus when they supposedly lived according to the geologic age. So in looking at the geologic age, here starting up here at present with human beings at 0 years, going in years backwards, going all the way back here to 650 million years ago. We talked about last night, 550 million years ago, the Cambrian explosion is right here. Well, dinosaurs fall in what's this time period here, the Mesozoic. We talked about Devonian and Ordovician animals that have obviously not evolved over time according to the fossil record, going all the way back into the hundreds of millions of years. But geologists today, using various modern principles, which we can't go into, we just don't have enough time tonight, that they suppose the idea is, and using radiometric dating, that dinosaurs and their fossils associate with these rocks in what's called the Mesozoic, the Cretaceous, Jurassic, and Triassic, what lasted some 245 million years ago to 65 million years ago, at which point a great extinction event occurred and the dinosaurs disappeared from the Earth. The problem with this idea is that in theory, they use strata to ultimately identify their index fossil, which is a particular fossil that falls in a certain time frame. That particular index fossil is radiometrically dated, or at least the rock that it's associated with it is. And then that is ultimately used to determine what the age of the rock strata is. This is called circular logic. And circular logic has a problem in that whatever you build into your model is ultimately going to be your result. And so today, whenever a scientist wants to submit a rock specimen for age dating, for instance, the first thing the laboratory is going to ask you is which rock stratum or formation did it come from? What does that help them do? Narrow down the numeric window so they know how to get the dates right. So they won't do it blindly. And in fact, whenever you ask them to do it blindly, they just reject it and refuse it. Why? Because they know this is never going to work. So they have to have preconceived ideas built into their models. So when it comes to fossil succession, we looked last night at the tree of life and how all of these various species ultimately came into existence. I want to focus just for a moment on just the dinosaurs. And this is a representation. You don't have to see all the details of all of these, but this is a representation of all of the dinosaurs. And the time period is represented by the red line. The red line is actually fossils found in various strata correlating to these these particular dates. So here we have at the bottom the Triassic in blue, Jurassic in kind of this aqua color, and then Cretaceous in green. Then 65 million years ago at orange there, there's an extinction event, and only the birds actually made their way forward. So what's interesting about this is you get an idea of how long dinosaurs supposedly existed based on how many successive layers of the rock record you find their fossils. And that's how you ultimately build this. The problem with this is this is purely statistical, and it's only based on the discoveries current to date. Meaning, if you find another one tomorrow, for instance, it's up here, and it found way back here, you've got to extend the line. Well, what does that do? Well, that modifies how you interpret how they're related, because what happens is you ultimately assume the oldest found must be the earliest in the evolutionary chain, and those found later have to be later in the chain, so you have to connect the dots. So what do? They take this data, and watch closely, they ultimately create all of these connections evolutionarily based on when they exist and the likenesses to one another, such as through speciation, is at least their assumption. But the problem with that is that they create this entire family tree, but they only have that much data to work with. So what's the problem? They have to build in tremendous assumptions to get their model to work. And we saw that last night with certain missing links that didn't even exist yet. They hypothesized their existence someday, hoping they'll find them, and if not, they build their model anyway. They don't worry about it. And it's really, it's not science, it's ultimately assumption. So when it comes to the evolutionary tree, we understand there's all of these particular connections amidst dinosaurs today. And supposedly, then, birds come from those dinosaurs. So then the question is how did the dinosaurs become extinct if they did go extinct 65 million years ago? There's a lot of competing theories. Supposedly, an asteroid hit the Earth somewhere around the Yucatan. Supposedly, there might have been volcanic eruptions emitting H2S gas and various other things, hydrogen sulfide. There may have been global warming. There may have been global cooling. If you have another theory, it might fit like this one. But I'd even propose to you, it doesn't have to do with the dinosaurs never making it on the ark during Noah's flood. Because I think the Bible will support that dinosaurs lived after the flood and were seen visually and noted in the Bible. We'll talk about that at the very end. So what's the modern belief based on what we've seen thus far? So what's taught today in the classrooms is that the first discovered and correctly identified dinosaurs are really in the late 1700s. Now, this isn't overly emphasized in the classroom because it creates a conflict we're going to investigate here. But the idea is what we've learned, we know for certain they weren't identified until the late 1700s. And so it's a very young science. And we didn't really appreciate even what they looked like until the late 1800s, and so it's really young. Dinosaurs lived supposedly 65 to 245 million years ago. They evolved from a common ancestor. They are the predecessor of the evolution of birds. They died out in some sort of mass extinction, though it's still debated as to what it was. They never coexisted with humans, which only came into existence in the last 10,000 years, or supposedly 100,000 years if you want to least associate hominids, which we investigated last night. They are the icons of Darwinian theory and evolution and proof, supposedly, of an ancient Earth, and there is no room for creation or intelligent design when it comes to dinosaurs. Now, here's the thing. And again, last night we set up our own test. We hypothesized this. Let's set all of this to the hypothesis of, is that true if a dinosaur was never seen or ever discovered, or ever identified, or visually represented before, and we'll go ahead and we'll give the most conservative number, the late 1700s. The late 1700s. So let's put that to the test here this evening. So, to once again reemphasize, Roy Chapman Andrews, in The Days of the Dinosaurs, which was published in 1959, and is still quoted from in modern textbooks today, said dinosaurs lived many, many millions of years ago. That was before there was any people. No human being ever saw a dinosaur. All of these great lizards disappeared millions of years before men, women, and children appeared on the earth. And the reason he puts this out there is because obviously there's a lot of movies and things out of Hollywood that depict humans living with dinosaurs, and they want to be very clear scientists. That never was possible. So don't believe in Hollywood. Believe us. There has never been a human sighting of a dinosaur. Even the good source Wikipedia says, the popular ideals of dinosaurs have many misconceptions reinforced by films, books, comics, television shows, and other media. Typical errors including prehistoric humans living with dinosaurs. So no human being should ever have lived with a dinosaur. So the hypothesis is, if this is true, then there should be no literary description or artistic depiction of dinosaurs in human history prior to the 1700s when scientists started to discover them for the first time and piece them together. So, what do the Neanderthals have in the past? They have some amazing artwork in some caves, don't they? We have some amazing things that are found about them. And they made sculptures of prehistoric animals fighting in what's called the Bernafal Caves in France, renowned for Neanderthal artifacts. And here is one of those renditions. And this particular rendition is protected today. But you see something here. It's really hard to make out. But here's an eye. Here's a head. Here's a body. Here's a head. Here's a body. Here's some arms. Here's a better rendition of that. And what it looks like is some kind of elephant-like creature. Mammoth, maybe. I don't know. But then something with a reptilian-style head, body, and little short arms. Well, it doesn't take a child long to figure out what that's possibly. And, of course, it's very poor quality. But it could be a dinosaur. Could be. All right. That's a weak illustration. It's going to be the weakest you're going to see. Let's move forward. And, again, we're going to move around the world. We're going to look at various artifacts. How about in Egypt? What do the Egyptians know about animals? Well, they know quite a bit. And, in fact, they have many representations of animals typically in their artwork. Cats, lions. They're really infatuated with the cat, the feline side of the animals. But they have showed dogs and many other things. But in the 3300 B.C. era, there is what's found is what's called Mesopotamian cylinders, cylinder seals. And ultimately what you would have done is you would have put wax on some kind of parchment or some kind of decree, and you would have rolled this particular seal across it, which would have left some kind of impression, letting you know who ultimately has sealed this, because each one of them would have been different. And these are actually on display at the Louvre in Paris. But what do they look like? They look like this. Here's the rolled seal, and you put it on the end of a stick, and you'd roll it across, and it makes this artistic impression of this big-bodied animal, long legs, long neck, and a long tail. Sure looks like a dinosaur. How about one found in Hyrcanopolis, which is a slate palette that's dated around 3000 B.C., and here it is. Here's a human individual. It's interesting. He has a slave, and he's a taskmaster. He's driving the slave. Kind of makes you wonder. Egyptians, Israelites, maybe he's in the right time frame. Don't know. But what's over here on the right side is interesting is that, again, you have big bodies, long legs, long tails, long necks. Looks very similar to this animal. And yet, there are others that have been found also. Same representation, same body style, found on many different artifacts from the 3000 to 3300 BC time frame. How about Western United States? There are petroglyphs found at Natural Bridges, Utah, drawn by the Anasazi Indians somewhere between 150 BC and 1200 AD, because we don't know exactly when they occupied that region. It's a large time frame, but notice, even at the latest date, it is 500 plus years younger than the science of paleontology and the dinosaur discoveries. And here we have a human individual over here on the left, and we have this animal over here on the right. And as you can see, body with a long tail, long neck, serpentile head. Also in a petroglyph found at Havasupai Canyon in Arizona. Again, here's something with a bunch of animals on this particular cliff wall. Notice that one right there at the bottom left. Here's what it looks like. And yes, kind of looks like a dinosaur. Interesting. How about Peru, South America? In 1571, Spanish conquistadors reported of Inca ceremonial burial stones with strange creatures carved on them, meaning they were creatures that hadn't been identified before, or at least not recognized by the conquistadors. Over 1,100 of these stones were found in tombs in Peru, dating during the 1930s is when the discovery was made of these. And what we find is that in cases like this, a human being with a bird, with an animal with a large body, legs, long tail, long neck, and head. Doesn't look like anything as far as animals you'll find at the zoo today, but it does look like a dinosaur. How about this one with a man here with a sword, knife, spear, whatever that is right there in his hand, trying to fend off the attack of what looks like a dinosaur while being attacked by a dinosaur. And then in this particular case, here's a man with a spear once again attacking a dinosaur while being attacked by a dinosaur. How about Australia? The Aboriginal tribes of North Queensland, Australia, relate stories of what's called Yuru, a creature which used to inhabit rainforest watering holes, which had a long neck, large body, and flippers. And in this pictorial, you can see it here as the Aborigine try to attack it and kill it. And it looks a lot like a plesiosaur. In fact, very accurately renditioned in the Crystal Palace Park in London, as one of the sculptures showed a little bit ago. And of course, here's what it looks like in the fossil record, supposedly 100 million years old. Mexico. Nearly 33,000 ceramic figurines were found buried at the foot of El Toro Mountain, the bull, near Acambro, Mexico, identified as pre-classical Chipequaro culture, which dates to 800 BC to 200 AD. It's not a dog, it's not a cat, but it surely looks like a brontosaur, apatosaur, a dinosaur. Cambodia. We know some work being going on in Cambodia. And of course, I hope Brother Jonathan has a chance to go over and see this. I know he's been to the temple, but I don't know if he's able to go and see this particular element. But we find there that there is a Buddhist temple that is 800 years old with palaces located in the jungles and a remnant of what's called the Khmer civilization in Angkor Wat. And back in this particular palace is various temple areas which have artifacts drawn on them. And in this case, you see a native down here at the bottom. And up here, you see an animal. We'll zoom in on the animal. The animal looks like this. Some have proposed it looks like a hippo. But the problem is this so-called hippo has a long tail, which hippos don't have. And it also has these large plates down its spine, looking a lot like a stegosaur. Italy. Italy's got a unique situation in that during the first century, Roman mosaics were ultimately all the rage. You wanted to have one in your house, and you would hang it as the tapestries in the home. But what's interesting is that Mount Vesuvius ultimately had a massive eruption. And what ultimately happened was that the city of Pompeii was buried. And when Pompeii was buried in the volcanic ash and rubble, ultimately you've just put a time preserve on an entire civilization. And by preserving that civilization, whatever you find buried in that rock, only discovered in the last 100 to 200 years through excavations, that ultimately that is a snapshot of time going back to the time we know Mount Vesuvius ultimately erupted. And what's interesting about it is what they found under the debris. And what they found in one particular tapestry is this one. This particular mosaic shows children playing with giant lizards. I don't know exactly what this animal is, but that one definitely is more lizard-like. And this one's actually trying to attack it, I guess. But these are just pulling it like a mule. And in this particular one, you see that the locals have entrapped one in a cave, and you can even see the Greek up here at the top left written across the wall, and you actually see the animal looks like a lizard. And here are even locals attacking again, some lizard-like creature. That's preserved for a century. China. The dragon is a popular symbol in Chinese culture and is one of 12 real animals depicted on what's called the Chinese zodiac or calendar. Here's a picture of it, and notice there the dragon. Notice you have rabbits, tigers, oxen, rat, pig, dog, rooster, monkey, sheep, horse, snake, dragon. Why would you have one fantasized animal with 11 real animals? Well, the artifacts of the Shang Dynasty going back to 1100 to 1700 BC, showed here in jade, as well as in another mineral called a cinnamonrite, ultimately depict very accurately a protoceratops, the only animal to have this head frill or armor on its body, along with a horn. Of course, you can have animals with horns, but nothing else in all of the animal kingdom compares to the head frill of the protoceratops. And that's a dinosaur. How about this one out of silver? Sure looks like, based on the unique shape of the head with the back plate of the bill, as long as the spiny part of the rear part of the spine, sure looks like a Cerulophus. And that, again, is a dinosaur. These artifacts look like dinosaurs, and it should be making you wonder, how did the ancient world know what a dinosaur looked like? So why haven't we heard about this? The reason so many of these artifacts are not publicized or well known is due to a conscious attempt to suppress this type of information, since it goes against the modern paradigm of evolution. Why would scientists want to share that kind of knowledge with you? And why would they not want to suppress it if it goes against one of the biggest money makers in the world, which is evolution? And I say that because, what do professors ultimately get paid to do? Research. And what do they want to ultimately do? They want to find new discoveries. What are they constantly publishing about? New discoveries, and sometimes they're about dinosaurs, or they're about new species that are being found, because evolution is all the rage. Of course, today we might throw in global warming. But if you deal with evolution, you're going to get published in Nature. You're going to get published in Discovery. You're going to get published in Time Life. You're going to have the opportunity to be in Newsweek. Whatever it is, you get the opportunity to elevate yourself, and therefore, it's lucrative business. But also, you write for the textbooks. You write for the magazines. You ultimately deal with Hollywood. And of course, Jurassic Park is teaching and preaching evolution all the way through those particular films. It's big business. And so, they don't want the competition. And hence, the billions of dollars spent every year in scientific research, museums, textbooks, and all sorts of entertainment. So what about the idea of dragons? Dragons, obviously, going back to the Chinese culture, dragons are talked about in many places in world history. And so what about dragons? Well, the dragons of legend, according to World Book Encyclopedia, are strangely like actual creatures that have lived in the past. They are much like the great reptiles or dinosaurs which had inhabited the earth before man was supposed to have appeared on earth. Again, emphasizing the paradigm of evolution. Dragons were generally evil and destructive. Every country had them in its mythology. Every country talked about dragons. Every country, every civilization talked about a dragon. Well, are dragons of old dinosaurs in history? And the reason I propose that is because the word dinosaur wasn't invented until Sir Richard Owen. So what was the ancient word? Could it have been dragon? Well, let's notice some of the historical texts and what it has to say about dragons. Alexander the Great, we believe, was real, and certainly historians would teach him to be real. Well, what did Alexander the Great have to report? He reported that when he conquered what is now India in 326 BC, his soldiers, the greatest, strongest fighting force in the world, were scared. And what were they scared of? They were scared of the great dragons that lived in the caves of the region. They were scared. Even in their great fighting force and their size, they were still scared of these creatures. Marco Polo, yet another historical figure that surely we would believe, visited China and said the emperor was raising dragons to pull chariots in the parades. We just saw a first century mosaic that showed children pulling with reins certain lizard-like creatures. Now, do you think Marco Polo lied when he put this particular account down in his memoirs? Well, surely not. So he saw dragons as well. Remember, the dinosaur word did not even come into existence until 1841, Sir Richard Owen. So, here's a recent, more recent, this is 12 years ago now, but of course it's associated with a film that's still extremely popular today. Draxoric hodwartia was recently discovered in South Dakota by an amateur paleontologist, ultimately donated to the Children's Museum in Indianapolis in 2004. It was named for the Dragon King of Hogwarts after the dragon depicted in the Harry Potter movies. Here is a depiction of supposedly it in the movies. Here is a skull that was found in South Dakota, looking very similar to it. And here is its full body put together, pieced together after all the bones were found. Can you see the idea that a dragon could be ultimately represented in this creature? Yes, it most certainly could. But here is its tainted artistic impression by scientists to get away from that particular idea. In the book, the Bible, there is obviously dragons identified. And when you see the word dragon in the Old Testament, that's where you'll find it. You will find it in the Greek in the book of Revelation as well. But mainly you find this word in the Old Testament. And the Hebrew word for it is tanyan. So I want to show you a couple of biblical passages where tanyan is used in the Old Testament. Why? Because like what we've been noticing with Marco Polo, Alexander the Great, and also all of these artistic artifacts that we find, the Bible is a historic piece of literature. And if you don't believe it to be inspired, you have to at least appreciate it that it's a historical text. And if it writes about things as fact, you need to ask yourself, what is it describing and what is it ultimately making a reference to? Well, let's see what the Bible has to say from a historical standpoint. Jeremiah chapter 14, verse 6, written around 600 B.C., giving us at least a date and the time of this writing, says this, "And the wild asses did stand in the high places. They snuffed up the wind like dragons. Their eyes did fail because there was no grass." Now, the interesting thing is that in modern versions of the Bible, dragon is translated as jackal. Jackal. Now, here's the problem with that particular idea is we have to look at the context of this word used everywhere in the Bible to see if it's consistent to the idea of a jackal. And I'll propose to you that a jackal, a wild dog, hyena, is not always going to fit. In fact, notice here what the description is by Jeremiah. Jeremiah says, "The wild asses," we know what an ass, a donkey is, "did stand in the high places. They snuffed up the wind like dragons." First of all, you're making a comparison of donkeys or asses to that of dragons as if the dragon is a real comparison. The comparison is that these animals end up like these animals, which snuffed up the wind, and their eyes did fail, which is a nice way to say they died. They died because there was no grass. So ultimately, the asses, the donkeys, died because there wasn't enough vegetation to support them. They died. What did Jeremiah just allude to? These animals died just like dragons died for lack of food. Interesting. So remember, the question was, how did dinosaurs ever go extinct? Some believe, well, maybe they never made it past the flood. Some believe that, well, maybe they went extinct from some cataclysmic event in ancient Earth time, but we've seen now that dragons have been identified in more historic time, human time. Well, now Jeremiah, 600 B.C., after the flood, of course, says they died for failure to have enough sustenance or food to support them. Isaiah chapter 43, verse 20, written around 700 B.C., says, "The beast of the field shall honor me." This is speaking of God. "The dragons and the owls," there's our word dragon once again, "because I gave waters in the wilderness and rivers in the desert to give drink to my people, my chosen." Again, the word jackal is used in modern translations. It's dragon in the older translations. Notice here the situation. Dragons and owls. First of all, there's a unique connection between the word owl in the Bible. There's two words for the word owl in the Bible. When it's actually the bird, the owl that we know of, that goes hoot, hoot. It's a different word than this word. This word is unique and only found in the case of dragons. And if it's a flying beast and if it's associated with dragons, it could be a flying dragon. It is an interesting word, but the writers did not know what word to call it, so they applied owls, even though there's another word for owls in the Old Testament, just thought. Thought-provoking context for you. But the idea of these dragons, it says here, God supposedly gives waters in the wilderness. Why? To support beasts of the field and all living creatures. And rivers to the desert, again, supplies and supports life, even in a desolate location, to give drink to my people, my chosen. Now, the interesting thing is to give drink not only has to do with drinking literal, it's the idea of having sustenance or things to sustain life. Well, what is it also saying? Beasts and dragons and these owls are supposedly a source of support to life, meaning they're food. They're food. Let me show you another verse that supports that, written around 1000 BC in Psalm 74, verse 13 and 14. Thou didst divide the sea by thy strength. This is obviously speaking of God once again. Thou breakest the heads of the dragons in the waters, speaking of obviously marine or aquatic type dragons, and breakest the heads of Leviathan, a very specific type of dragon we'll note here in a moment, and gavest him to be meat to the people inhabiting the wilderness. What happened to the buffalo in the Wild West days? The buffalo in the Wild West days was over hunted. It wasn't just a source of food, but it was hunted for its bone and its skins and things of that nature. Even though it's a magnanimous beast, it was almost hunted into extinction by humans. And you think to yourself, how could a human with just a simple spear or a bow ultimately hunt down an animal, let alone tons of those animals in the prairie lands of the mid-continent of the United States? Well, they didn't always just hunt them, trying to trace them down with a bow and arrow. But sometimes man would do, because man has the ingenious to do such, they would find ravines or gorges or dig out holes, and they'd run the animals full speed into these spots and an opportunity to kill them. Man has creative ways of killing large animals, and has certainly done so and very successfully in time past. What could have possibly happened to the dinosaurs is that, if you think about it, in all reality, that when man steps off the boat in the flood, Noah and his children, and they have all these animals they release to go out and repopulate, and civilization starts to grow, and you've got the opportunity to go out and hunt and supply for not just your family, but your village or your civilization or whatever the case may be. And as the mighty hunter, and you want to go out and get the best bang for your buck, are you going to hunt squirrel or are you going to hunt something much bigger? You're not going to hunt a bunch of squirrel. You're going to hunt the things that are bigger. And man has always done that. It's why the whaling industry is out there. It's why cattle are obviously herded and used as livestock. You obviously want to get the most bang for your buck when it comes to food supply. And it says in the Bible, these animals were given as meat to the people inhabiting the wilderness. Here, dragons in this case, because it is a water-type animal, is sometimes translated serpent or sea monsters in these particular cases. In the modern translations. So Job 40, verses 15 through 24. Last couple of passages here I'll share with you and we'll close our lesson. Written around 1000 BC, again, after the flood, Job writes this in Job chapter 40. Look now at the behemoth, which I made along with you. And I'll get to that down at the bottom here in a moment. He eats grass like an ox. So he compares this behemoth to that of another animal, an ox. See now his strength in his hips and the power in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. All right, well, I'm going to stop there for a moment. Behemoth in the modern translations is translated, hippopotamus. Hippopotamus. You all know what a hippo looks like. What does a hippo look like? Does it have, in this case here, a tail like a cedar? No, it's a ropey little thing with a little puff on the end of it. Now, it's a very strong animal. It has strong hips. You might describe it as having bones that are like bronze and ribs that are like bars of iron, as it goes on to describe, but it doesn't match all the other description. Look what it goes on to say. He is the first of the ways of God, meaning he is preeminent. The hippo is not at the top of the animal kingdom, but this animal is. Only he who made him can bring near his sword. Surely the mountains yield food for him, giving you the scale of the food this animal needs. and all the beasts of the field play there. He lies under the lotus trees and the covert of reeds of the marsh. The lotus trees cover him with their shade. The willows by the brooks surround him. Indeed, the river may rage, yet he is not disturbed. He is confident, though the Jordan gushes into his mouth, though he takes it in his eye, or one pierces his nose with a snare. Now, if the Jordan is in full flow in the spring, there may be the chance for a hippo to be swimming in it, but the hippo is going to get washed downstream if he doesn't make his way to shore. This animal's not moved by the mighty Jordan in the rush of the spring. And so what could it possibly be? It could be this. We don't know. We don't have enough depiction. But the idea of the grandeur of this beast and the scale of it is obviously being depicted by God speaking to Job, God describing the animal in Isaiah chapter 40. Then God goes on to compare another animal to Job in chapter 41. Can you draw out Leviathan? Here's that unique word. And this word here in modern translations is denoted as crocodile. And we'll see if crocodile matches this word as we read on. You can draw out Leviathan with a hook. Sure, the idea of a crocodile could fit. Or snare his tongue with a line which you lower. Can you put a reed through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Well, yeah, you can do that with a crocodile, but this animal can't, supposedly. Will you make many supplications, or will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him as a bird, or will you leash him for your maidens? Will your companions make banquet of him? Now, there are places that obviously make banquet of crocodiles. There are certainly people, weird people, who wrestle them, who try to close their mouth, and once they close their mouth, they can't open up and clamp down on you, and you can lead them around on a leash once you tie them off. Yeah, they're a hideous creature, and they make a lot of noise, and they certainly give you a good fight. But you can suppress one of these animals, and a single human individual can do it. It is possible. What God is saying to Job is, this animal isn't that. This animal can't be put in that situation. What does it go on to say? Verse 5, will you play with him? Number 6, will you make a banquet with him? Will they apportion him among the merchants? Yeah, I believe some nice boots and belts are made out of crocodile skin. Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Sure you can with a crocodile, not this animal. Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. Never do it again. Indeed, any hope of overcoming him is false. Shall one not be overwhelmed by the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me? Well, if it's not a crocodile, could it be something like this? There are some nasty looking animals out there in the dinosaur kingdom. Based on size, based on the terror look of them, the size of their teeth, all those things. It is possible. We don't know all the detail here. It's a surmise of myself I'm obviously inputting here. But if dinosaurs did live in human periods, which we have seen have been shown to be factual, there are plenty of artifacts and ancient writings that would support it, then is the Bible also speaking to these so-called dragons as dinosaurs and yet another account of them? And can then, if that is true, can then we believe the credence of the rest of the inspired word, and that dinosaurs and beasts and all animals were created on the sixth day just as man was? And if that is true, then the rest of the story is true, and then the co-creator is also true, the co-creator being Jesus Christ according to John 1, and then we're accountable to him as well as the creator, God himself. So what is the scientific evidence today? Let's summarize. Geologic time and evolutionary theory are based on numerous assumptions. We studied a lot of that last night. I think we're seeing some of that here even today. True science allows the evidence to speak for itself without forcing the data to fit preconceived parameters. At the end of the day, if there's ancient artifacts of dinosaurs seen by humans, we have to accept it. But that's not what science today, modern science, is doing. It's in fact denying it and suppressing it, saying it can't be true because it attacks our theory. And a theory is nothing more than a glorified opinion. It is a glorified opinion, yes, based on certain interpretations, but it's an opinion at its very heart. So the theory of evolution is still just a theory today. And the modern scientific community is dismissing all evidence that does not fit the evolutionary paradigm, especially if it has reference to creation or intelligent design. Why? Because that makes man accountable to a higher being. And we don't get to be gods unto ourselves. We have to answer to a real God, a real creator. And there are huge implications of that as we read through the Word of God in the Bible. So, I leave this with you. Psalm 104, verse 24. O Lord, how manifold are thy works. In wisdom hast thou made them all. The earth is full of thy riches. I don't believe tonight the dinosaurs are an icon of Darwinian evolution. But instead, I think dinosaurs ultimately create a problem for those that would believe in evolution. And when we look and examine all the evidence, not just the evidence they want to push upon us, then we have some hard questions to answer about what do dinosaurs really tell us. Do they tell us a story of evolution? Or do they tell us a different story that lends credence to the story of the Bible? And if it leads credence to the story of the Bible, what are we going to do about that? Will we accept the story of the Bible? We accept the message God has for man, His plan for man? And that under the time that we live in today, where Jesus Christ went to the cross, died for us, and ultimately established a covenant between man and God, a covenant, a contract that we have to meet with all sorts of details outlined in the New Testament Scriptures. And if we're accountable to that, then we have to ultimately fulfill that, because within those pages is ultimately described a blessing for those who will do it, keep it, and honor God, and treat Him as He is, the Creator of all things, and respect Him for such, and respect Him for the great sacrifice Jesus ultimately gave for us, or to deny that, and if God be real, then answer in a day of judgment and face the penalty for denying His great power, denying Him as the Almighty Creator of all things.